Chilili, Rome.
Increasing the number of...
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Wrightcraft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a Prime Minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations' devolved governments are essentially self-governing, this has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, the UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England only. He doesn't seem to care about the union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved governments and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions, with Wrightcraft claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard-right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag-waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
This is the first time in over four decades that a South Korean Prime Minister visits Iran. Chung Sik-yoon arrived in Tehran on Sunday for a three-day visit that aims to boost bilateral ties. During his trip, Chung held talks with high-ranking Iranian officials, including Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf and Ali Larijani, who was an advisor to leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Chung's historic visit is viewed as an icebreaker to forge stronger ties between Seoul and Tehran after years of strained relations. Now to start with, Tehran says Seoul should unlock billions of dollars of Iranian assets frozen in its banks. The figure is roughly $8.5 billion of Iranian revenues made from oil sales to Seoul. The funds are now blocked in two South Korean banks for fears of running afoul of U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Tehran says South Korea's inaction toward the issue has been the main barrier in the way of further development of bilateral relations.
Unfortunately, relations between Tehran and Seoul have not seen any development in the past 3 years due to South Korea's adherence to U.S. anti-Iran sanctions that lack any international legitimacy.
The South Korean premier said his country is determined to solve the issue and will make its utmost efforts to prepare the ground for Iran's access to its assets.
South Korea will increase its cooperation with the related countries to unfreeze the Iranian financial resources. This is to get both sides out of the current deadlock in bilateral relations.
Before the U.S. intensified its sanctions on Iran, South Korea was one of the country's largest trade partners outside West Asia and its fourth largest oil customer. Following the 2015 nuclear deal, bilateral trade reached $12 billion in 2017. Yet these exports tumbled down after the U.S. reinstated anti-Iran sanctions in 2018, dropping to minus $90 million in the first half of 2020.
South Korea used
also a permanent market for South Korea technology, from car to home appliances. But this active trade partnership was abruptly halted by United States sanctions. And I think the two sides have made up their mind to resume their friendly ties despite the United States' will.
Chung's visit follows the Islamic Republic's release of a South Korean oil tanker about 3 months after its seizure over alleged oil pollution. The move is interpreted by observers as an act of rapprochement that, if Seoul compensates by releasing the Iranian assets, can open a new chapter in the two countries' political and trade ties. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
The Islamic Jihad movement and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine held a sit-in in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The event took place near the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing in northern Gaza. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights. The Israeli regime has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons.
The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine came together today to express solidarity with the prisoners who are languishing in Israeli jails. The conditions of prisoners are only getting worse as days go by under the watchful eye of the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are subjected to degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits. Palestinians say that Arab countries normalizing relations with the Israeli regime are encouraging Tel Aviv to violate the rights of Palestinians.
The normalization by Arab regimes has badly affected the conditions of Palestinian prisoners. Normalization of ties with the Zionists is a betrayal of Palestine and the Palestinian prisoners. All Arabs must understand that the United States and Israel are the enemies of the Arab and Muslim nations.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and the symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, vowed to use all forms of resistance to free Palestinian prisoners.
The so-called peace deals will not free Palestinian prisoners. Only resistance can free Palestinian prisoners from Zionist jails. Capturing more Israeli soldiers to exchange them with Palestinian prisoners must be a top priority for all Palestinian resistance groups.
Statistics show that over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967 due to medical negligence.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Israel is currently holding some 5,000 Palestinians behind bars, including women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says two of its drones hit Jizan Airport and King Khalid Air Base, both in southwestern Saudi Arabia. The army says this is part of intensified attacks to retaliate Riyadh's ongoing war on Yemen.
We are entitled to carry out the attacks as part of our normal and legitimate right to respond to the escalation of Saudi Arabia and its comprehensive blockade on our country, and we promise the Saudi regime more painful operations as long as the aggression and siege continues.
His comments come as, over the past months, Saudi Arabia has either roundly denied any Yemeni attacks inside the country or claimed Yemeni missiles and drones were intercepted before making impact.
The Saudi regime realizes that it may lose face if people of the country come to know about the Yemeni attacks. The Saudi regime is controlling its people by force, and it is afraid of an internal revolution against the ruling regime. So, this is why Riyadh continues to avoid talking about the Yemeni attacks.
Military experts say the Yemeni army is well capable of expanding its attacks to a wider range of targets to make them more painful for Riyadh. They say this could inflict greater damage to Saudi Arabia economically and militarily.
Saudi Arabia must realize that the painful phase is yet to come. Saudi Arabia will lose its economic power and military capabilities in this phase. Saudi Arabia says its army is the sixth most powerful army in the world, but 6 years of war on Yemen have proven that the Saudi army is extremely weak and has achieved nothing, while the Yemeni military capabilities have increased. And I believe that the continuation of this war is further damaging to the kingdom.
The Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is a response to the deadly Saudi-led aggression and siege that caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of them women and children.
Saudi Arabia has been calling for peace talks with Yemeni forces to stop their attacks while refusing to grant their demand to end its years-long war and siege on Yemen. This leaves the Yemeni army no option but to step up its retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul. The visit comes amid tensions between Kiev and Moscow over Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, Russia bulked up its military presence on Ukraine's eastern border, threatening military action. During the meeting, the two presidents spoke about ways of cooperation in different sectors and strengthening ties between the two countries, including free trade, tourism, and sports. Following the meeting, which was also attended by ministers from both sides, a number of agreements was signed.
Turkey strongly defends the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. We hope that the escalation in eastern Ukraine will come to an end and the conflict will be resolved through dialogue based on the Minsk Agreement.
The United States, after informing Turkey as per the Montreux Convention, sent two warships through Turkish straits towards the Black Sea. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the warships will stay in the Black Sea until May 4.
The tension between Russia and Ukraine is increasing every minute. Ukraine is waiting for support from the EU and the US. But Russia has clearly expressed that Crimea is its red line and will not give it to Ukraine. I think this visit is aimed at sorting things out. Ukraine wants to make sure that Turkey is on its side, especially after the phone call between Turkish and Russian presidents.
Late on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed with his Turkish counterpart over the phone the Ukraine crisis and the presence of U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Turkish President assured that Ankara's cooperation with Ukraine does not mean it is against Russia. Analysts believe Turkey is trying to play the role of peacemaker in the region without taking sides. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was an utter shock for the destitute Rohingya community in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather, it gives government more freedom to act swiftly. Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of people. We had argued that even non-citizens, even refugees, have Article 21 rights, the right to life.
In recent weeks, dozens or more refugees were detained from New Delhi. The police maintains they have orders from higher authorities to carry detention process. Now grief has befallen the destitute community. Rights activists say treating these refugees differently is a blow on India's ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family.
Why is it not our concern if there are refugees coming from there? It's not just the refugee law. There are so many laws dealing with the rights of children, the Human Rights Convention, the Civil and Political Rights Convention. They all talk about the principle of non-refoulement, which means that you cannot send somebody to a country or outside your territory where there will be danger to his life or limb.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden will withdraw American combat troops from Afghanistan by 11th of September, declaring an end to the nation's longest war and overruling warnings from his military advisors that the departure could prompt a resurgence of the same threats that sent hundreds of thousands of troops into combat over the past 20 years. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Helen Cooper, Thomas Gibbons Neff, and Eric Schmidt. The piece is titled, Biden to Withdraw All Combat Troops from Afghanistan by 11th of September. President Joe Biden will withdraw American combat forces from Afghanistan by 11th of September this year, declaring an end to the nation's longest war and overruling warnings from his military advisors that the departure could prompt a resurgence of the same threats that sent hundreds of thousands of troops into combat over the past 20 years. In rejecting the Pentagon's push to remain until Afghanistan security forces can assert themselves against the Taliban, Joe Biden forcibly stamped his views on a policy he has long debated but never controlled. Now, after years of arguing against an extended American military presence in Afghanistan, the president is doing things his way, with a deadline set for the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. A senior Biden administration official said the president had come to believe that a conditions-based approach would mean that American troops would never leave Afghanistan. President Biden's decision would pull all American troops out of Afghanistan some 20 years after former President George W. Bush ordered an invasion after the September 11 attacks on New York and the Pentagon. The war was launched with widespread international support, but it became the same long, bloody, unpopular slog that forced the British to withdraw from Afghanistan in the 19th century and the former Soviet Union to retreat in the 20th century. Nearly 2,400 American troops have died in Afghanistan in a conflict that has cost about $2 trillion. Mr. Biden's Democratic supporters in Congress praised the withdrawal, even as Republicans said it would risk American security. The United States went into Afghanistan in 2001 to defeat those who attacked the U.S. on 9/11, Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, said in a statement. It is now time to bring our troops home, maintain humanitarian and diplomatic support for a partner nation, and refocus American national security on the most pressing challenges we face. John Saltz, an Iraq War veteran and chairman of the Progressive Veterans Group, Vote Vets, said, words cannot adequately express how huge this is for troops and military families who have weathered deployment after deployment with no end in sight for the better part of two decades. However, President Biden's decision drew fire from Republicans. This is a reckless and dangerous decision, said Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, the ranking Republican on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator Inhofe said arbitrary deadlines would likely put our troops in danger, jeopardize all the progress we've made, and lead to civil war in Afghanistan, and create a breeding ground for international terrorists. Former President Donald J. Trump had set a withdrawal deadline for of 1st of May, but he was known for announcing and reversing a number of significant foreign policy decisions, and Pentagon officials continued to press for a delay. President Biden, who has long been skeptical of the Afghan deployment, spent his first 3 months in office assessing that timeline. The Afghan central government is unable to halt Taliban advances, and American officials offer a grim assessment of prospects for peace in the country. Still, American intelligence agencies say they do not believe Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups pose an immediate threat to strike the United States from Afghanistan. That assessment has been critical to the Biden administration as it decided to withdraw most of the remaining U.S. forces from the country. A senior Biden administration official said the troop withdrawal would begin before 1st of May and conclude before the symbolic date of 11th of September. Any attacks on withdrawing NATO troops, the official said, would be met with a forceful response. Meanwhile, Taliban leaders have long pledged that any breach of the deadline means that their forces will again be attacking American and coalition troops. Under a withdrawal deal negotiated during the Trump administration, the Taliban mostly stopped these attacks, but in past weeks, they have rocketed American military bases in Afghanistan, particularly in the south and east of the country. In public statements on Tuesday, 13th of April, Taliban leaders focused not on President Biden's decision for a full withdrawal from Afghanistan, leaving behind a weak central government that has proved incapable of halting insurgent advances around the country, but rather on the fact that the Biden administration was going to miss the 1st of May deadline. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mojahed, speaking on local Afghan television, said, "We're not agreeing with the delay after the 1st of May. Any delay after 1st of May is not acceptable to us." The American-led war in Afghanistan was won and lost several times over the past two decades. The initial campaign, in which relatively small numbers of special operation forces partnered with local Afghan militias supported by American airstrikes, was quickly successful in forcing Al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders to flee, mostly into neighboring Pakistan, by late 2001 and early 2002. Many military analysts praised the mission as a good example of planning and war fighting. But then the war evolved and expanded from a counterterrorism mission to one devoted to nation building. But the inability to create effective local security forces in Afghanistan allowed the Taliban to stage a comeback, prompting a significant surge of foreign troops back into the country starting in 2009, an effort that effectively amounted to a second invasion of Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the Biden administration officials are saying that the United States would reposition American troops in the region to keep an eye on Afghanistan and the Taliban, and would hold the Taliban to a commitment that there would not be a reemergence of a terrorist threat on American or Western interests from Afghanistan. But it was unclear what that meant or how far those repositioned forces would go to protect, for example, the fragile Afghan government or Afghanistan's national security forces. The Biden administration officials are saying that some troops would remain in the country to protect American diplomatic presence in Afghanistan, a standard practice. Joe Biden's top aides have said he's keenly aware of the risk of a total security collapse transpiring in Kabul, the Afghan capital, if all Western troops leave the country, and he has privately described a fall of Saigon scenario as haunting. But in private meetings in recent weeks, the president has also questioned whether the small remaining contingent of American forces can accomplish anything after 20 years, during which almost 800,000 U.S. troops have been deployed to Afghanistan, or whether it will ever be possible to bring them home. The cost for the war and reconstruction effort is estimated at about $2 trillion.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Just 2 days after the Israeli regime's sabotage at the Natanz nuclear facility, Iran announces the terrorist act has not been able to achieve its goal of hampering the country's internationally verified peaceful nuclear program. Iran will not only replace the damaged centrifuges with more advanced ones, it'll also put to operation 1,000 more advanced centrifuges soon. On top of that, Iran will raise uranium enrichment level from 20% to 60% as of tomorrow. And all this while, Tehran is engaged in talks with the P4 plus one of Vienna regarding the lifting of U.S. imposed sanctions aimed at reviving the nuclear deal. Stay with us for a debate on different aspects of this issue.
Iran has officially informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of its plan to start enriching uranium to a 60% purity level as of Wednesday, following Sunday's act of sabotage against the country's Natanz nuclear facility that Tehran blamed on Israel.
Yesterday, we send a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current number of machines. Also today, we just send a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%.
Araghchi said the terror act against the Natanz site will help boost Iran's enrichment capacities. He also touched upon Iran's demands that it would put forward during the upcoming talks with the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA in Vienna.
We insist on what we have asked, that all sanctions should be lifted, we verify, and then we go back to full compliance if we are satisfied with the verification process.
President Hassan Rouhani also said all parties to the 2015 pact must honor the commitments they made while inking the accord. The Vienna talks that will be held this week have been eclipsed by the sabotage incident at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility. In a letter to the UN chief, Iran's foreign minister blamed Israel for the incident, saying the move amounts to a war crime and nuclear terrorism. Mohammad Javad Zarif also denounced what he called Israel's terrorist idiocy, saying the regime has made a very bad gamble by sabotaging the Natanz facility that would strengthen Iran's hand in talks to salvage the JCPOA. He also warned the U.S. that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage can serve as leverage in JCPOA talks.
Americans should know that neither sanctions nor acts of sabotage will give them leverage in the negotiations, and that such measures will only make things harder for them.
Israeli media have acknowledged that Israel was behind the incident at the Iranian nuclear facility, but the U.S., Israel's closest ally, has denied any involvement. Nonetheless, on the same day that the Natanz site was targeted, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was meeting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed again to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal, but for now, the sabotage act at the Natanz facility has further deepened Tehran's distrust towards Washington.
Okay, now let's start the debate here. Joining me tonight here will be security analyst Mohan Abedin in our Tehran studios. We'll also have journalist and commentator Julia Qasem is joining us out of Beirut. Good to have you, both of you in the show. Now let's go to Mohan first. Mohan, this is not the first time that the Tel Aviv regime is trying to throw a wrench into Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Now, the irony is that the hostile action prompted Iran to further its nuclear activity. As of tomorrow, as you know, Iran will start uranium enrichment at 60%. The country will also put to operation 1,000 advanced centrifuges. It looks like that the Israeli scheme has failed again, don't you agree?
Well, you know, Israel and other hostile states have been trying to sabotage Iran's civilian nuclear program and other critical national infrastructure for more than 15 years now. And these sabotage operations have taken different forms: cyber attacks, terrorism, bomb attacks, the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. And with all these attacks, undoubtedly, they gain some operational or technical advantage. But these attacks have never, ever, up to now, managed to change the big strategic picture. They do not change Iran's calculus and Iran's determination to go ahead with its development plans. Now, today's announcement was a very good example. These hostile states, we assume it's Israel, it hasn't been confirmed yet, took action against a critical national infrastructure, and Iran's response is to speed up nuclear enrichment from 20% to 60%, bring into line new state-of-the-art centrifuges, a new generation of centrifuges. And bear in mind, much of the centrifuges that have been damaged in previous attacks, they belong to a previous generation of centrifuges. So they were, by today's standards, pretty useless anyway. So in direct answer to your question, a hostile state will undertake these actions with a view to gaining some kind of a tactical advantage. But the bottom line is they do not shift the strategic picture. They do not have the desired outcome for the perpetrators. And that's the important point.
Okay. Now, let me turn to Beirut. Julia, U.S. Defense Secretary was meeting with Israeli officials at the time of the Natanz sabotage. He spoke of everything except this country's opposition, to Tel Aviv's sabotage of the Iranian Natanz facility. Why should Washington engage in talks to revive the nuclear deal, as it is claiming, at the same time, allow Tel Aviv to target Iran's nuclear facility?
Yeah, as was just said, that the cyber attacks against the centrifuges, it has been a tactic in the works for over 15 years now. The first time that it was implemented was through actually a Dutch mole in collusion with both the CIA and Mossad. So time and time again, these cyber attacks have been an act of collusion between the United States and Israel, which kind of do not act independent of each other remotely, I believe. So it's pretty understandable that there is a collusion going on in their aims of sabotaging Iran's nuclear program. Right now, the Biden administration is kind of operating under the facade of wanting to do negotiations, but on the U.S.'s terms, which is why essentially the talks failed, as the deal failed as well. And with Israel, it's just more of a rogue strategy of kind of achieving the same objectives of sabotaging Iran's nuclear enrichment development. But of course, as we know, Israel is very short-sighted in that regard. Those centrifuges, as was mentioned, were old anyway. They were due to be replaced. So Iran's response in resistance to Israel's attack, but also in full assumption of its own right to develop energy, sovereign energy, has chosen to increase the enrichment to 60% as of tomorrow. So I believe that based off the historical precedent of these cyber attacks, as well as the coinciding goals that both the U.S. and Israel have against Iran, ultimately, that they couldn't have been acting in the courts.
Okay, now, Mohan, in the same lines, I want to put this question. Could Tel Aviv have taken this hostile action it took against Iran without informing Washington and getting its green light?
Well, the short answer is no, and I tend to concur to some extent with your guest in Beirut. These actions, these sabotage actions or cyber attacks or other forms of hostile activity, they tend to be collaborative. So it's a case of collusion between several hostile states. Very rarely do they happen independently. Now, we know with the biggest attack to date, there's the so-called Stuxnet attack back in 2010. This was a collaborative effort between the Americans and the Israelis. Now, we don't have sufficient information to determine the extent of collusion in the latest attacks. But the bottom line is that the Israeli entity, you know, it doesn't have the strategic capacity or even wherewithal to act independently. This is this is an established fact, I think, and most experts would concur with that. So, and of course, this creates all sorts of questions because some of these hostile states, whilst they're trying to actively sabotage Iran's nuclear program, they're also at the same time pretending to be engaged in dialogue and diplomacy. So that really calls into question their motivation and their sincerity. And I think this is something which the Iranian diplomatic establishment has to contend with. Just how serious are their diplomatic interlocutors sitting at the other side of the table? Yes.
And of course, Iran has not waited for that, man. Iran is doing its job no matter what comes out of those negotiations.
Well,
now,
just to finish my point, absolutely.
Sure.
So, there's several dimensions here. There's the security dimension, the strategic dimension, and the diplomatic track.
Mm-hmm.
As I explained with the actual nature of these attacks, the damage that they inflict on Iranian infrastructure is at best tactical. They don't change the big strategic picture. And most important of all, they do not alter Iran's strategic calculus. And today's announcement is a testament to that.
Mm-hmm.
Iran has announced that it's going to actually intensify its activities in the nuclear sphere in response to this particular sabotage operation.
Right. Julia, Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif has asserted that neither sanctions nor sabotage can serve as a lever for Washington in the nuclear-related negotiations going on, as you know, if that's what they are pursuing. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, actually both of those things have been factors that actually motivate Iran to pursue its more sovereign strategies of nuclear enrichment, economic development, nuclear development. But kind of goes to show it's a miscalculation on the U.S. end. And it's why it almost seems like the strategy of, you know, getting Iran to negotiate on the West terms seems like a little bit more of kind of like a diplomatic way of actually sabotaging it and slowing down its nuclear development. As we can remember, a couple days ago, it officially looked like the talks were failing, even though the premise of them, where Washington didn't want to remove the sanctions, poised it to fail from the get-go. But as we kind of saw the confirmation of Washington, you know, not wanting to remove the sanctions, not wanting to live up to its commitments, really, I believe that Israel kind of like launched this last-ditch effort to try to sabotage the centrifuges. But of course, just like the sanctions, that only encourages Iran to further move on its plans to develop its enrichment, you know, enrich its uranium and kind of produce a more sovereign strategy of economic development, given that, you know, the parties on the other side of the table directly or in collusion with these sabotagers to begin with.
Let me ask Mahan this question, that Tehran has strongly criticized, Mahan, what it calls Tel Aviv's nuclear terrorism, because it wouldn't only impact Iran, it could have led to a large-scale environmental issue endangering other parts of the world, too. So the end justifies the means. That's the Israeli approach, right?
Well, this is a really good question, and it speaks to the recklessness of these attacks. The attacks we've seen over the past 15 years have been really dangerous because they are targeted at critical infrastructure. In this instance, a nuclear facility. We know that nuclear facilities the world over are vulnerable assets. We saw the Fukushima thing back in Japan in 2011, other instances when nuclear infrastructure, civilian ones for that matter, somehow become vulnerable, and that just poses huge environmental challenges and huge pressures. Now, in this instance, thankfully, there hasn't been an environmental impact, but the fact remains that attacks of this kind, with callous disregard for the immediate environment, indeed the broader environment, and as you just stated, potentially the global environment, it speaks to the recklessness of these actors. So if the question is, does the end justify the means? Certainly from their point of view, it does. And this just goes to show how important it is for them to halt Iran's progress in the scientific sphere. You know, they are absolutely obsessed by this because they've been taken aback by Iran's strategic momentum in other areas, in the regional domain, but Iran and its allies are victorious. They have the strategic advantage. They have seen how the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy, which amounted to of an attempt to economically paralyze Iran, they saw that has not worked. The Iranian economy has proven to be much more resilient than they ever anticipated. So they have seen these gains on Iran's part. They have seen that they cannot get the strategic advantage in a conventional sense. So they resort to these attacks with a view to arresting Iran's strategic momentum, with callous disregard for anything else, be it civilians, you know, civilian casualties and damage to the environment.
Julia, Iran has stated clearly that it does reserve the right to revenge in due time, and some analysts criticize it for not giving a strong response to the Israeli move, and there are some others who are praising this as self-restraint that's being practiced by Iran, which they argue that nullifies Tel Aviv's intention to instigate Tehran to kind of rush to take some hasty and harsh action in response. In what context do you assess Iran's stance?
Yeah, so I would say that it's not, you know, restraint in the sense that it just kind of wants to be the peace broker just for the kind of, for a pacifistic sense, for a pacifist sense. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that there's really anything to criticize because, I mean, one, what do most of us know about the strategic analysis that Iran is really taking with regards to its response? But also, Iran's not going to respond on Israel's timetable because Israel's going to want to take harsh action based on what it believes is going to be advantageous to it and enable it to kind of wage further strikes against Iran in just a very restless way, of course. Of course, Netanyahu wants war. Of course, the Zionist entity wants war. And they want it in a way that gives them the second strike advantage and that could be predictable in their regard. So, of course, Iran is going to respond, but it's going to respond strategically. It's going to respond with full intentionality and with full respect to its strategy, its own strategy, not Israel's. So I think this actually is what really terrifies Israel, that it is able to have a lot of restraint in the short run, and in order to achieve its goals in the long run. And Israel knows it can't, it can't really be successful in any military confrontation ultimately, against Iran. So it just tries to also sabotage them militarily by inciting some kind of short-term, small-scale retaliation that Iran did this.
Now, Mahan, as you know, negotiations are underway in Vienna, and you know, Arafat is there, and they are starting it tomorrow officially. Not much was achieved in the first round of the Vienna talks last Friday, though. So, what do you expect could come out of the second round that's starting tomorrow? Will go on for a couple of days. Tehran has asserted, of course, as you know, that it wants all the U.S. sanctions. You know, and all the U.S. sanctions means those imposed during the Obama term, during the Trump term, to be removed at one go.
Well, as far as diplomacy in Vienna is concerned, Iran's position really hasn't changed. Iran's position was set out some time ago by the leadership and then further down by the institutions that are tasked with foreign policy. So Iran's position is if Iran is going to scale back its actions of the past 18 months to go back into full compliance with the JCPOA, then sanctions not only have to be fully lifted. In fact, they have to be verifiably lifted, and that takes time. So it's right. No good for the Americans to say, oh, we're going to lift sanctions. Can you go back into your commitments now? Absolutely not. These have to be verified. Mm-hmm. For instance, Iran will have to be able to sell its oil in the international markets without any obstacles or hindrance, and other sanctions.
And also get access to the money.
Yeah, and other sanctions. I was about to say that. Other sanctions targeting the financial sector, Iran's blocked assets around the world, they have to be unfrozen, and Iran needs immediate and full access to that. So these have to be verified. So the position in that regard hasn't changed. But look, just take a look at the discussion we've had this evening. Now, if this proves to be a synchronized attack by, say, two hostile states, I'm not going to name them because you know we don't have that information. So this is purely speculative. So if one party, for instance, hopes to gain some kind of leverage over this attack. So, you know, they would argue that Iran's leverage has been removed as a result of this attack, so it's easier to negotiate with them. Then the Iranian negotiators are going to prove them very wrong, because that bottom line is not going to change. It didn't change with the first round of the Vienna negotiations, and I suspect it will not change with the second one. And let's take stock of the broader strategic picture. The former U.S. administration imposed what they called maximum pressure policy in Iran, which amounted to a kind of economic blockade. That was an abysmal failure. The current administration in the U.S. concedes it was a failure, and yet it doesn't have the moral courage or the political conviction to actually reverse that policy. Mm-hmm. So until they reverse that mindset and reverse that